Hey, Brad, decoration's still up, huh? It's a very important trophy hanging from your mirror over there. No. I love that the festive spirit lives within you still.
I invite you into my home.
Yeah.
And you come in here and you pass judgment on my decorating preferences.
Look, I've talked up your light choice a lot.
That's true.
I have given a lot of people reasons to burn. I'm probably responsible for at least 5 or 10 tons of carbon dioxide in the air.
Tens of dollars of wasted electricity. Yeah,
from encouraging people to go back to incandescent Christmas tree lights.
I mean, at the time of this recording, the 12 days of Christmas only ended 3 days ago?
Wait, did the 12 days of Christmas start on Christmas or before Christmas?
Yeah, they run through January 5th.
What?
Is technically the last of the days of Christmas.
How did I never know this?
Yeah, so I mean, I feel like up through the 5th, your anything goes as far as decorations, but I mean, where are you guys at?
Gina took the ornaments off yesterday. She's okay. Taken apart all of the Christmas themed Lego.
Okay. Still have remnants though?
The lights are still on the outside of the house because the weather's been too crappy for me to go out and take them off.
So I'm in a game of Christmas tree chicken with an apartment across the way.
Oh yeah.
Behind the building here.
They still have theirs up?
They've got a full size, like, you know, 6-7 foot blinking colored lights. The whole works. Theirs is still up. So as long as that tree is still up, I think I'm okay.
I was at the tested office in the Mission the other day and we went to lunch and walking through the Mission.
Oh, I bet it's just a graveyard.
It's great because like everywhere you walk, you're brushing up against old Christmas trees and it smells terrific.
Yeah, that's kind of sad to me though. It really seeing them just laying there bare naked on the sidewalk.
Look, part of the Buddhist practice is acknowledging that death is a part of life.
That's fair.
And
you have to learn to let go.
Yeah, you have to. The time is done. It's the time has passed.
You ever burn a Christmas tree?
I mean, that's what we used to do exclusively.
Yeah, exactly. That's the
time. We'd go out in the backfield.
Yeah.
We'd use that to start the junk pile.
Uh-huh.
Look, I grew up in the country, so when we had shit that we needed to get rid of, we didn't take it to the dump. We just had a hole back in the back that like we'd tractored all the dirt away, the burnable stuff away from.
My girlfriend she didn't know how flammable a Christmas tree truly is because she'd never seen one burn before. I was like, you have no idea.
Oh yeah.
It's like gasoline. The thing explodes.
What is it? Is it steel wool? I think we used to use steel wool, like not an SOS pad, but steel wool without soap on it. Like just a plain steel wool, and you pull it apart a little bit and spark some magnesium in there and then hit it with a spark and it's just like it explodes. Like Christmas trees go up faster than that.
It's just like a bomb in your living room.
Hey, Brad.
Hi, Will.
Welcome to Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod.
Let's make a tech pod.
It's the number one tech podcast by two guys who sit around and talk about one thing once a week.
In sweats of various types.
And sometimes take questions.
Yep.
This week, though. This week's topic. We're going to talk about how real the stuff we saw at CES is.
The tidings of the new year. Yes. The Consumer Electronics Show is upon us.
I'm going to go ahead and tell you, there is nothing that makes me happier.
Can I stop you? I guess?
Yeah, go ahead.
Not having to annually go to CES?
Like, I don't mind Vegas, although we used to go for like 10 days, which was a lot.
Wow, are you kidding?
Well, when we were in the whiskey basement, we would take the van, we would load up everybody spare in the office, as many people as we could fit into the van, then we'd drive 11 hours to Vegas.
Was there really 10 days worth of stuff to do at CES?
No, the problem is everybody gloms onto the beginning and end of it. So there's like drone stuff out in the desert 3 days before, and then there's 2 days of press conferences, and then there's 3 days of show, and then you're like, I just want to die.
Like, I've been to, even the game industry used to have plenty of
Vegas
press events, and I definitely decided that like 72 hours is the absolute limit.
So there's three things that are important. There's three Vegas rules for me. One is that you don't stay in a casino that you have to, you don't stay in a hotel that you have to walk through a casino to get to your hotel room.
Does that exist?
Yes, it definitely exists. So like Planet Hollywood, what used to be the Planet Hollywood Towers and I think is now the Hilton. There's no casino. You just walk, there's like four slot machines, but you can walk straight in from the door, go up an elevator and be in your,
I mean,
your,
you can't even get through the Vegas airport without being
you bombarded
with,
Well, but the nice thing about that is you don't have to walk through cigarette smoke necessarily to get through. You don't have to walk through thick cigarette smoke to get to your hotel room.
Sure.
Two, I don't drink when I'm in Vegas, which it turns out makes Vegas much more tolerable because you're tired and you feel shitty and you feel kind of gross all the time, but at least you don't have a hangover.
Yeah.
And then the third one is eat vegetables, like eat good food. Like if you eat Vegas food the whole time, you'll die.
Bad news.
Yeah. The first year we went to Vegas and stayed for 7 days, it tested, I think I gained like 14 pounds. 2 pounds a day. It was pretty good.
Those buffets never stop.
Yeah, no. And then after after you do that, like if you do that and you like try to sleep, even when we were sleeping like 3-4 hours a night, it was okay.
Got to take care of yourself.
I don't miss going to CES though.
I haven't been in God, probably 2007 was the last time I went.
Yeah.
Why do they insist on having it the first week of the year? Like,
because it's cheap,
really.
Yeah, the convention space is really nobody wants to have a convention. 250,000 people come there, or
Isn't the tech industry incredibly wealthy at this point?
You don't get wealthy by spending pissing away money on prime convention center tech space.
Conference in July.
Over the years, CES kind of changed though from consumer electronics to computer. For a while, it was all computer stuff and car stuff, and now it's just like anything goes, man. Mm-hmm. E-cigarette vape business happening there.
Vape juice and
there's sex toys,
TV stuff, and sex toys.
Sexual wellness
food
devices. Food,
because food is tech now.
Well,
everything is tech.
Food is tech. There's car stuff. There's more car stuff now. There's self-driving cars. It used to be It was like subwoofers for your car.
Yeah, we are experiencing global techification of everything, right? So.
Oh God, we're doomed.
Like anything,
machine learning stuff's there, I guess.
Anything could be at CES because everything is tech.
I remember one year I went and every single like tiny booth you went into had an ebook reader, like with an e-ink screen. Hmm. I was like, man, these things, how many people are buying these books that have no store attached only to read pirated ebooks? Turns out a lot of people.
Those books are pretty small.
Who knew? But yeah, so there have actually been. Wirecutter used to joke that there was like one article worth of things to do to talk about that came out of CES that were real and good.
Yeah.
And they would go and make one. It was a pretty long article. It was like one. They'd send 20 people and make one article, which I thought was hilarious. But this year, there have been a couple of things that are actually impactful and that probably we'll have to talk about in the future because I don't think we want to dig in all the way on them today. But like Bluetooth LE audio.
Is that in your mind? Is that the thing? Is that the biggest news out of here? Or it certainly seems like maybe the most actionable or relevant news.
I think it's the most real. It's the thing that's going to affect people soonest, probably.
Okay.
Like it won't be on the phones that you have now currently, probably.
So it's not going to be backwards compatible. This is not going to be a firmware update.
It'll be backwards compatible, but it won't be firmware update.
That's what I mean. It can't be enabled in existing phones.
It doesn't seem like it. That's unclear to me. I could be wrong. It seems like it's something that when we get the next gen of SoCs on phones and the next gen of the embedded chips that make Bluetooth headsets work, Bluetooth headphones work rather. It's the thing that's going to do that is what it seemed like to me.
Okay.
But then there's some other stuff too. Like AMD announced an enormous 64 core Threadripper, which
128 logical cores.
Yeah. It's, I mean, look, it's a $4,000 processor.
Yeah.
It's not for us.
No.
But you can buy it's, we talked about chiplets last week. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of chiplets. Holy crap.
We'll just do a quick overview here. We've got 360 hertz screens. We've got Impossible Pork.
Yeah. So unicellular grown pork products. I don't know if they're unicellular.
Yes.
So they were talking, one of the things out of the Impossible.
Are there grades of Impossible meat?
Well, I don't know. It's all the same. Okay. It's how they shape it and how you shape it and stuff like that. Have you cooked with that stuff at all yet?
No, I've never tried it.
Oh, so it's interesting. I've had a Whopper and I feel like I had a burger at Jardinere before that shut down.
Huh. Are they doing the Whopper everywhere?
The Whopper's everywhere now.
Like literally
you
every
could go to a Burger King.
I could get to a Burger King. Maybe I should just go try that.
I mean, look, we could take a break between the podcasts, go get Impossible.
I'm not recording any more podcasts after Burger King. This is a pre-Burger King podcast.
I had my first fast food cheeseburger of the year on the way over here because I hadn't eaten yet.
Who got the honor?
I went to Wendy's. Okay. I find it's the best mix of decent fries and decent burger.
Did you do the junior bacon cheeseburger?
I went with this awesome bacon cheeseburger that has some sort of slightly spicy mayonnaise on it. It's like a sauced up aioli and some tomatoes.
Sounds fancy.
Good burger. Yeah, pretty good burger.
I always thought of Wendy's as the fancy version.
They're square.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't go to Wendy's. You go to Wendy's for a three course. You get like your burger, your fries, and then a frosty afterwards.
Cup of chili.
Yeah. Baked potato. You like Wendy's? Baked potato and chili. I would just go get baked potato and chili for lunch sometimes when I work next to a Wendy's.
Lunch of kings.
So the Impossible announced pork. Mm-hmm. And then they were talking about how they feel like a lot of the meat protein products we eat are going to be based on unicellular life, not multicellular life.
Oh, that's what you meant.
In the future.
Okay.
Yeah.
Such as
like they grow bacteria and
yeast.
fungus and yeast and stuff yeah. that is engineered to produce similar nutrition and flavor and texture, and then form it into pieces that look like the Impossible Stuff looks like beef.
I think I will take that over insect-based food.
I've eaten insect-based food. Well, fine.
I've had it. It's, yeah. you know, it's certainly edible. It's just not necessarily very appetizing.
The cricket flour, like the...
So I didn't have anything that was broken down to that extent.
Oh.
To the extent that it actually resembled like existing food products.
Yeah.
This was more like, here are some fried crickets.
The cricket flour...
Here's a hot dog with some mealworms on it.
Man, the cricket flour has a really lovely taste. It's I had chocolate chip cookies made with it.
Oh, wow.
And probably wouldn't have realized that they were made with anything.
No kidding.
They were better than a lot of the non-gluten flour alternatives.
Okay. So, yeah, like once it's processed to the point that it resembles everyday food, I think I'd probably be fine with it.
But. Yeah, and the nice thing is like, when you're in your bunker, you can grow enough crickets to support your family of four in like right. a 4x4 box.
They're very green.
Yeah,
it turns out. All right, so are we doing pork now? Do you want to?
We want to just jump. Yeah, I don't know what to do here. This isn't a roundup podcast. How do we do this? I don't know.
Well, we're talking about the pork, so let's finish the pork.
Okay.
But I read about it, and like, I really the gist of the story I read was, hey, they announced Impossible Pork. Like, there wasn't a lot of other detail there in terms of like how it's being made or how it's differentiated other than
it tastes like pork.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's ground pork and sausage. Mm. So presumably now you can make an Impossible meatloaf because you need pork and beef to do meatloaf.
Yeah.
But like if you, it looks like they're going down the most first, the easiest targets. So like ground beef, Americans eat a ton of ground beef.
Yes.
Americans eat a ton of ground pork yeah. in terms of sausage and stuff like that.
What I did not know looking into this is that according to the UN, pork is the most consumed protein in the world.
Because of Asia.
Yeah,
yeah.
But I still would have guessed it was chicken.
Yeah.
I don't think chicken's even number two, actually.
Wow, we killed a trillion. We have gotten so much weird chicken yeah. mail lately, by the way.
Right.
We talk about chicken farming one time. Yep. And
the global fossil layer of chicken bones.
Yeah, the avian age.
But yeah, I didn't realize pork was the predominant meat in Asia. And you know, obviously like Impossible wants to expand into China, so pork is an obvious next step.
Yeah.
But do you think the genesis of this is the same as the beef? And then at some point in the production process, did they differentiate the texture and the flavor somehow?
I mean, the texture is kind of, if you think about ground pork versus ground beef, the texture is similar. A lot of the texture on the Impossible Stuff comes with how you cook it.
Ah.
So when we've tried it at home, it doesn't have fat. Like unlike normal beef, it doesn't have, the ground beef doesn't have fat.
Okay.
So you have to use oil or butter or olive oil or some, add some fat yourself.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Or else it doesn't brown properly because you need that fat helps the Maillard reaction. It gets hot enough that the Maillard reaction can happen.
Maillard reaction again.
We love the Maillard reaction here. So yeah, I'm interested in trying it. I feel like breakfast sausages mm-hmm. are a good place to start with that.
Sure.
And they're selling, it seems like they're going to sell a sausage version and a just plain ground pork version.
Okay. Ultimate litmus test for this stuff.
Yeah.
Can you make good white sausage gravy with it?
I can't imagine can you make
proper biscuits and gravy with this Impossible?
So here's my secret shame. Most pork sausage that you get now does not have a high enough fat content because most American pork is low fat. Huh. So I almost always add lard to the ground,
even to
pork
the
fat.
Good old Jimmy Dean.
Unless I do so we do the Jimmy Dean organic.
Oh.
Just because it's less salty. Like the Jimmy Dean straight is so salty, I can't eat it.
I didn't think I would ever hear the phrase Jimmy Dean organic in my life.
It's ludicrous, right?
It sounds like an oxymoron.
But it's much lower salt, so it's not like I like when I'm back east, mm-hmm. Tennessee Pride mm-hmm. is the sausage of choice.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's okay. It's a classic Tennessee brand.
So we didn't have a local brand.
Oh, you just did Jimmy Dean?
We just went with the old JD.
Hey man, it was hard when I moved here because they didn't have JD. But yeah. the JD organic is, I think, better than Tennessee Pride.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, but yeah, you're gonna have to add a lot of fat. Okay. You could use butter though. I mean, I guess butter is not gonna be vegetarian, but it'll be not gonna be vegan, but it'll still be vegetarian.
Sure.
So yeah, Impossible Pork.
Yep, that's happening.
Do you want to save the Bluetooth stuff for the end, or you want to jump right in
and get to it? I mean, that's the thing. Yeah. We have the most bullet points on here, so let's get into it.
So what is Bluetooth LE?
I guess the LE stands for low energy.
That sounds right.
There are multiple components to this, and I have had a little bit of trouble separating them out.
Well, it's like a network stack because there's like a hardware layer, and then there's a
I think at the bottom is the LE, which is the signal.
Yeah,
it's a specific type of signal. So they're using that for audio now. And then within that, there is a new codec called LC3,
which is higher quality, lower bit rate.
That's how they're pitching it.
Okay.
So from the sound of it, this is going to be kind of the new baseline Bluetooth audio standard, because all the comparisons I've seen out there have been against SBC, which is the old, like, that's the lowest common denominator Bluetooth standard, right?
Yeah.
That's the one that everybody supports.
That's the one that, like, worked your old Bluetooth headset right. 15 years ago. Right.
So, like, if you've got AirPods, they do better than that. If you've got, like, I don't know, you know, like, Qualcomm's got their aptX stuff, which is higher quality than mm-hmm. that. But SBC is the one that any cheapo $20 off the shelf
and is
pair of headphones is going to support, I believe.
Okay.
In my defense, detail, like untangling the mess of Bluetooth audio codecs is very difficult.
Reading through how this works made it really clear to me that we need to do a whole Bluetooth audio work.
Like, there's a lot there.
Like, at a real high level, there's a weird thing with Bluetooth audio where when you're using your phone and, like, plugging it, like in the old days when your phone had a headphone jack, you would plug the phone in and there'd be a digital to audio analog converter, a DAC, on the phone,
right?
That would basically turn the digital signal, the digital slices of the audio signal,
just into an electrical signal,
into a wave,
right,
yeah,
that goes up the cord.
Yeah, and now that lives on the Bluetooth headset,
right,
behind the radio, yeah. And there's like a network pipe essentially that runs over Bluetooth. Bluetooth has a kind of low bit rate. I don't know what it is now on modern Bluetooth. I should look that up. But anyway, okay. So there's a new pipe. There's a new codec that lives inside that pipe. Presumably, people can continue using whatever codecs they were using before.
I guess so.
Whether it's SBC or AAC or aptX.
Yeah, but it sounds like LC3, this new codec, is going to give you better sound quality at the same or low bit rates.
The thing that was interesting to me about this is that it's multiple independent synchronized streams.
So in terms of, like, usability, that seems like the thing that actually matters the most. I hadn't considered this, but I mean, it makes perfect intuitive sense that current true wireless earbuds, you know, the AirPod style, you know,
yeah,
are essentially only connecting one of those to the phone, and then it's shooting a beam straight through your brain.
Well, that's
straight
great.
Through your brain to the other ear.
That sounds terrific.
Like, I mean, when I say that makes intuitive sense, like, there's no other way that could work, right?
Well,
but I never actually stopped to consider, oh my God, these headphones are just beaming the audio straight through the skull of everyone using them.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever. It's low energy radio waves. It's not.
Yeah. As far as we know. No. This isn't as far. There's been multiple.
I know. There's been tons. Running longitudinal tons and tons of studies.
You got to be careful because the chemtrails people are out there.
Yes, I know. Oh, dude, forget the chemtrails people. The Wi-Fi people are out there.
Yeah. Oh, God.
The cover your house in tinfoil.
The people who moved to West Virginia to the low. Do you know about the low radio zone
in
West Virginia?
No.
Oh, so there's. There's an area in West Virginia that's...
This is some kind of, like, Luddite utopianism. Let's find a geographical area that will block all the radio signals that...
Well, it's where there's big radio observatories.
Control our minds.
And they do radio experimentation there, so they don't allow you to use... Like, the normally public bands are off limits, so you can't do cell phones, you can't do Wi-Fi.
I see.
You can't do...
So it's a natural dead zone.
It's a natural dead zone. So okay. All the people that are, like, EM sensitive move to West Virginia in the mountains.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the more you know.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Anyway, yeah. So this new standard will allow you to connect, my understanding is, multiple devices at the same time.
So not just two earbuds, but, like, you and I could be listening to the same Bluetooth stream from my phone, which is really cool.
Right. Simultaneously.
Like, yeah. That'd be nice for, like, airplane, sitting on the airplane, yes, and stuff like that.
From a usability standpoint, that eliminates one of the things I hate the most about Bluetooth, which is having to manually swap between devices.
Oh, right. Because, yeah, you usually have to go in and disconnect one and reconnect,
like,
the other.
Like, I only have one pair of earbuds and I have them connected to my iPhone most of the time, but sometimes I want to use them with the MacBook and you have to go into some system settings and like, mess with stuff every time you want to change it back and forth.
Well, it's funny. That's one of those things. It's one of those reasons. Like, that's one of the things that made me get AirPods, was when they started supporting Apple TV, mm-hmm, the AirPods on the Apple TV, and you can just sit with your AirPods in and listen to the TV and not bother the people in the room with the TV.
Okay, so they make all that stuff seamless?
Yeah, you like, long press the play button on the remote and it pops up a menu. It's like, hey, do you want to connect to Will's AirPods, Gina's AirPods, what other devices?
So really, it sounds cool. Like, this is going to help automate a lot of that stuff, not having to manually fiddle with devices back and forth.
That sounds good.
What else do they have here? So basically that means, like, with this standard, both earbuds would connect directly to the phone.
That seems nice.
Yeah.
So no beam through your brain.
Right. Okay. So there is that. They're going to employ some kind of broadcast mode. I'm not sure how this would work in practice, but the example, basically the idea, I mean, I guess this is a similar concept to what we were just talking about, but the idea is a single audio source could broadcast audio to numerous devices.
Oh no. Like a silent disco, or
kind of
like the silent disco is the techno hippie like positive outcome here,
I guess so. Well, the example that they gave, which kind of actually seems sort of cool to me, is you could be in a sitting in an airport terminal listening to music on your Bluetooth phones.
Yeah.
And an announcement relevant to your gate could go out and they could broadcast that to you. You're closing your eyes right now. Like, potentially that could be kind of cool to have, like, you know,
let me paint you the counterpoint
relevant
here.
Relevant audio come in when you need to hear it.
I'm wearing my AirPods as I walk down the street.
Oh, God. Okay, you're right.
From Powell Street to your offices at 2nd and Townsend.
Yes, and you walk past Uniqlo or...
And I walk past Uniqlo and I hear Uniqlo music take over my AirPods. And then I hear an ad for Banana Republic that says, right, hey, if you come in right now and mention AirPods, you get 10% off.
You're right. This is
and
terrible.
Then I just throw them in the drain and never wear a pair of...
So, the thing I couldn't find information on is how you would authenticate with something like that.
Probably, you know, it's seamless, Brad. I would hope to think about it.
I would hope you would have to opt in to something like that.
Blink to authenticate.
Yes.
This doesn't sound good.
Yeah. There's also, I didn't quite understand how this works, but there's some kind of support for hearing aids.
Oh, in, yeah. So there's
with the standard.
Modern hearing aids have Bluetooth. Most mid to high end hearing aids have Bluetooth built in. There's also a whole new FDA class of non-prescription hearing aids that you can get.
Okay.
That do like selective audio boost in certain ranges and stuff like that.
So this is probably just designed to work with that.
Somehow. Yeah. So like having lower energy, since those hearing aids usually use disposable batteries, means that you'll get longer battery life out of one of your disposable batteries, which is a good thing.
This is cool because I have been wanting some better Bluetooth headphones for a while, but I'm also that curmudgeonly old fart that is always waiting for some better standard to come around.
Do you know about the $5 Alibaba AirPod knockoffs?
Yes. Okay. We talked about them,
didn't we?
Yeah, I was never quite brave enough to buy any.
Oh, it's time.
Maybe I should.
Get in there.
Maybe I should, yeah.
Can we talk about 360 Hertz G-Sync monitors?
Yeah.
So this came out of nowhere for me. NVIDIA has been kind of slowly, at the same time, opening up higher frame rate non-G-Sync monitors to work on their cards.
Yeah.
They've also been ratcheting up the speed that G-Sync works at. So there were, I think, 240 or 244 hertz displays last year.
Are they on the market yet?
You can buy those now.
Okay. But it seems like even the 240 panels are just kind of really starting to become widespread.
There was a Asus or Acer or Dell.
One of the three
common G-Sync display vendors had one.
Of course, I guess that, you know, CES doesn't mean that this product is ready to go on the market. It just means, hey, we have managed to achieve this.
This means that, well, so in this case, it means that they're targeted at esports people, not people who are into esports, but people who are like esports players.
Like literal actual competitor level types.
It kind of seems like the equivalent of like Nike making LeBron his own custom shoes that he like for or the guy who ran the marathon in under 2 hours making him a special pair of shoes.
Sure.
So they had NVIDIA had some data that said, hey, we're seeing like 30% higher hit rates on flick shots in the handful of games that actually will run at 350 frames a second.
Like that's the type of stuff I would like to hear more of. Like if there have been a lot of just straight up cognitive studies about how people process visual input.
So they brought in, I think, CSGO and Dota and maybe Overwatch players.
Yeah.
And they were seeing more accuracy. Like I'm in a weird spot with this because I've put, you know, 3,000 hours into PUBG almost. And I might be wrong, but I feel like I'm playing like a pro PUBG player would have been playing like 2.5 years ago. Okay. Right. Like I'm at that kind of a pretty decent skill level, but not anything modern and competitive.
At what refresh do you game?
Well, so I game at 60 hertz now because I have an older 4K IPS panel.
Oh, I figured you were in some kind of high refresh.
No, I need it's becoming clear. Like I've reached a point where I feel like the refresh rate's actually holding me back. Like I play with people who have 144 and 244 panels and they're able to see things like in cars because the higher refresh rate is reducing the blur as we're driving by. Yeah. So they're like, if we're going by at 100 kilometers an hour, they can see that there's a dude in the window that I just see a blurry window.
Yeah, they can make out a head and you just see a smear.
Yeah. So I'm curious to see. I talked to our friends at NVIDIA and we're going to see if I can get a chance to test these 360 hertz panels.
I would love to hear firsthand how those things
Yeah, I just want to see how they work. Yeah. I want to see if I can, like, I want to see if this is a thing that I can detect the difference between, you know, 144 or 240 and 360, or if this is just going to be for like 22-year-olds with god tier reflexes. Yeah.
And you should be able to, on a single panel, you should be able to test all those side by side, right?
I would think so. Yeah,
that would be interesting.
It's also worth mentioning these are really esports panels. They're 1080p, like 24-inch panels. Oh, they're small panels.
Wow. Yeah,
designed to be put into like competition spaces.
Image quality is not a priority here.
Probably not.
It is just refresh.
Probably just refresh rate.
I got to get one of those. I mean, I know we've talked about.
You haven't upgraded your monitors.
My monitors prevails, yes, but like, even if I go to like a press event somewhere to play a game on a nice high-end PC or something, like just the Windows desktop at a higher refresh is so much nicer.
If you don't upgrade like these just, by CS next year, somebody's going to sell a foldable phone that is bigger than your desktop monitors.
Okay, well, maybe I'll just mount one of those on the swing arm then.
Did you see that big Samsung monitor?
The absurdly wide one?
The absurdly wide one?
Yes.
Like it looks like...
What is the aspect ratio on that thing?
It's not. It's wider than 21.9.
That's too wide.
I agree. Mainly because having tried to play games on a 21.9 monitor for a long time, it was just always a hassle.
Yeah.
Like there was always something that, like, if you're playing old games, it's no big deal because they usually patch that stuff in later. But it looked really pretty and it supports high refresh rates, which I was surprised by.
That's cool.
Okay, what else we got?
Should we talk about filmmaker mode? Which I feel like there's very little to say about because it's kind of exactly what it sounds like. Well, actually, I don't know. I'm of two minds because
Yeah, we talked about the sun still entitled. This is This is the thing where the TV looks at the disc and is like, "Hey, this is a 24 hertz film."
So I don't know how they're determining it, but one of the things the TV makers are saying is that they do want it to be able to turn itself on automatically rather than the user having to toggle it on and off.
This is the solution for the my TV's in soap opera
this
mode.
This is for Christopher Nolan.
Yeah.
And Martin Scorsese.
Love that guy.
And who else has been out there complaining about this?
Tarantino. John Favreau. I think
Ryan Johnson has been out there.
Ryan Johnson seems like he would
whatever. Every filmmaker on the planet hates motion smoothing on TV.
Yeah, but look, everybody who enjoys watching TV that looks not like a soccer game yes. hates motion smoothing on TVs.
But especially people who really get off on the fine art of cinema.
Yeah. The point is clear. Like we have 4K TVs that are capable of incredible gamuts and like look spectacular, really good black levels, the whole thing. And then people turn motion smoothing on and set them to the eye blaster. I need to buy a new TV mode at Best Buy. Yeah. And it makes everything look like shit.
And so it's not just motion smoothing. This mode is going to also disable any other sorts of post-processing the TV is doing. So any kind of like weird dynamic contrast stuff or tinting or, you know, things that would throw off just the tone of the image.
Yeah.
In addition to the motion.
I'm all for that. I think this is a great idea.
It's a good thing to have. I don't know that filmmaker mode is the best way to present it to people. I could see that being a little confusing.
The thing that irks me and worries me about this is I play games and I watch films. And right now on my TV, I have to choose between game mode, which enables the low latency stuff, and like the THX good looking mode.
I mean, again, once we're fully in our glorious HDMI 2.1 future and this is out there and working properly, like ideally
it should just context aware switch.
Yeah. The way they're pitching this, you put in a UHD Blu-ray and it's the UHD like Alliance or whatever it's called that's pushing this. And specifically they're the ones saying like, hey, we want this to work automatically rather than you having to toggle it. So yeah, ideally you would throw a 4K Blu-ray in, it switches to filmmaker mode. You turn on your Xbox and play a game. It switches to game mode. Or low latency mode.
Like what if you've ripped a 4K Blu-ray?
Oh no! But you're playing it on your
Xbox with Plex.
Oh no! The robots. Yeah. I don't know if the robots are going to be smart enough to figure that one out.
Turn off motion smoothing, people. That's the TLDR for right now.
It sounds like this will not be trickling down to existing TVs. Like this is something that will only be in.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Future models. So there's that.
But and presumably it'll have to be supported by the player, the disc, and the TV.
I guess so.
Right. And I assume Apple and like the over the top. Set-top box people will have something equivalent.
Probably.
Because usually this stuff rolls out with discs, the disc alliance.
The disc
people are desperate to get any kind of press they can at this point, honestly.
I would believe that, for sure.
Can we talk about our stuff that isn't real section now?
Sure.
Sony is making a car.
Well, they made a car.
They licensed a car drivetrain.
They produced a single individual automobile.
A concept car.
I don't know that they're going to make any more.
Like the Prowler.
What's the Prowler?
Do you not remember the Plymouth Prowler?
The
best concept car of all time. It looked like a 50s roadster.
Yes, that's the one that looked super old timey.
And it had it had the fenders on top of the wheels, and the fenders turned with the wheels, but the wheels were exposed otherwise.
Was it purple?
Purple.
Yes, I do remember.
And then they turned that into the all time, one of the worst cars of all time, the PT Cruiser.
Okay. Yeah.
America's station wagon.
Sure.
Yeah.
The Vision S. Yeah. That's what the Sony's calling their
car. Is there a Z in there? Or is it an S?
No, it's just an S.
Boo.
It's an electric car. What drives something like this?
They have a R&D department that has to spend a certain amount of money each year or else they lose their budget.
I mean, that sounds like, if you're that technically minded, that sounds like a dream job, right? It's just get a giant budget and be told to go make something cool.
I mean, what's the difference between a car and a drone at this point?
Yeah.
About 2,000 pounds.
I guess so. I don't know. How do you feel about this thing? It feels like a fairly standard electric car from the sound of things, at least in terms of the actual driving of it.
So the first thing in the Verge article about this said, the company has no plans to mass produce the Vision-S, the car it surprised announced at the end of the press conference at this year's Consumer Electronics Show, nor does it plan to do a limited run. So it's literally a thing that they were like, hey, we can buy an electric car chassis and then make a showcase for all the ways that Sony Electronics can work inside your electric car.
Like when you lead off the pitch with, hey, we're never going to make any more of these, it's hard to get too excited about it.
It's like when Microsoft used to do those they'd build a fake house at CES, and they'd be like, this is what the home of 2010 is. And you'd be able to walk in, and they'd hand you a phone, and you'd see a video of Bill Gates playing on the phone. Bill Gates and The Rock would be playing on the phone. And then they'd tell you to hit a button on the phone, and it would start playing on the TV, and then it'd be on the wall behind the kitchen. And you know, you couldn't buy that house either.
They weren't that far off.
I mean, they nailed it.
Who knew? It just took 20 years to get here.
Yeah.
If you pull up the photo of the inside of this thing, like the dash.
Oh yeah.
Actually looks pretty fucking awesome.
Have you been in a car that only has screens in the dash?
No.
Have you ridden in a Tesla S?
No, I've never been in a Tesla, but there are regular makes of cars out there now that are kind of getting there, I guess. We rent Zip cars occasionally I'm occasionally impressed by how much of it is screen.
So
this is screen across the entire dash.
I wrote about this at Tested years ago, but I feel like there's something beneficial to having tactile controls in a car where you want to keep your eyes on the road.
Yeah.
As the cars get smarter and drive themselves more, that's less important. Mm-hmm. But this car very clearly still has a wheel and pedals.
Yeah.
A shifter.
What would you say the aspect is on these screens? They're very wide.
Some of them look like they're like 30:1. Yeah. 29:1 or
basically
something like that.
There are basically three extremely wide screens across the entire dash of this car. And then instead of side mirrors, they use cameras with two side screens.
I've often thought that the thing you really want to add to your rear view, your ability to glance at the space around you and see if it's safe to change lanes or move is some latency.
And potentially a point of failure.
Yeah.
The mirrors don't tend to stop working spontaneously.
I mean, have you seen one of the cars that takes the cameras, the wide angle cameras around the car, and then builds a top down picture of it for like when you're parallel parking, so you can see it, like shows you a picture of what the car looks like?
Interesting.
So Chevy Bolts do this, and I think the i3 does, maybe, I can't remember, but basically it sensor fusions all these cameras and de-warps them and then builds a top-down image of the car in the actual environment.
Yeah.
Not just like a representation.
That's cool.
So that you can see yourself backing in and stuff like that. I think that's maybe more useful than cameras in rearview mirrors. But
is that presentation good enough that you could look just at that and parallel park effectively?
It explicitly says not to do that, but yes, you can 100% look at just that.
Okay.
Yeah.
This thing's cool. I mean, it's neat to look at and from a car of the future kind of standpoint, but you know, again, it's not coming to market. So
no, I mean, this is the interesting thing about this to me is that I think that this is probably indicative of what's going to happen with electric cars, because they are close, and like, it sounds goofy to say, but they're closer to consumer electronics in terms of mechanical complexity.
Sure.
That you could just buy a drivetrain, and like Apple could buy a drivetrain from Tesla and put their own chassis and their own electronics, their own internal packages on that. And I don't think it's out of the question that there will be OEMs that just sell electric car bits.
Huh.
Probably not to the point that like you can go to, you know, car part builder and right. part together like, your own car.
You're not going to go on Newegg and order a drivetrain. And
yeah, because there's regulatory stuff that right. you would not be able to do. But like, I don't think it's out of the like the number of moving parts in an electric car are really low. It's like electric motors, maybe some cooling for the batteries, heating for the batteries, climate control and stuff for the central for the cabin, and then that's kind. And then the steering mechanisms and braking mechanisms.
Do you think it could ever get to the point where like large parts of the car are made at standard, like the parts are standardized in terms of like size and
or do you think Ford and Toyota will have the same chassis specs so you can just pick like, a Ford chassis off and bolt the wow
like I'm really straining the analogy here, but what I'm actually thinking of is like the old school head unit for the sound system,
the mini DIN,
right, which yeah. is like all standard, right, like that plug and that size, that space, that slot is a standard yeah.
There's thing. Standards for everything.
Right. So I wonder if like electric wow. cars could get to the point where they're
like you
so simplified that you can just kind of mix and match parts.
Like a PCI Express equivalent right. for car. Yeah, maybe. I don't, anything's possible.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes there's something about making things to the same size so that all the parts are interchangeable that makes them much less expensive. Because, sure. you know, you build one factory and you've built them all, right?
Sure.
I don't know. I am conceptually very interested in this.
Yeah. It's neat to think about. Real quick before we move on. I mean, you've been around the Valley for years.
Like, I have.
Is the Apple car, has the Apple car ever been real to any significant extent? No,
I like,
you've never heard any rumblings.
I have heard about the other things that have been rumblings. I've heard, I know of people who are working on black box projects at Apple that go to work at Apple and then just disappear for like 4 years.
Right.
I don't know any of the, I didn't know any of the car people well enough to know if they were car people that disappeared like that. I know that there's like a bunch of AR and VR people that disappeared into Apple and haven't come back. So presumably, you know, that indicates to me that Apple AR glasses are probably real. I wouldn't be in a position to know on cars.
Okay. Because this really kind of came out of nowhere.
Like it's like the TV. Remember there was supposedly yes. Apple was making a monitor that was had an Apple TV built in. And then it turns out they just sell the software to LG and people who are in the TV. Like,
yeah, I saw, like, I feel like the TV announcements were pretty bland this year. It was a lot of very iterative stuff.
Yeah.
It was pretty predictable, but I did see a number of models that say they quote unquote have Apple TV in them.
So that started, that was one of the big things that came out last year was Apple licensed to LG, Sony, Samsung, all the big vendors. And they said, look, here's the hardware you have to provide something that's viable. And those TVs support AirPlay. Like my dad has a Vizio TV in his living room that supports AirPlay and you can get Apple TVs. Like you can watch your iTunes stuff on it.
So do you get a front end that looks like the front end on a real Apple TV at that point?
No. So then your Apple TV becomes one store in your other front end.
Okay.
But like AirPlay works can AirPlay stuff from your phone, just okay. any Apple TV.
Okay.
Yeah, it was, I was surprised at how well that worked.
Hmm. Yeah.
Samsung's 8 terabyte external SSD.
Let's see. I think that's SanDisk.
Sorry, SanDisk.
Samsung's got the other
Samsung one. Samsung made one with a fingerprint reader. Yeah.
Yeah. 8 terabyte SSD.
I mean, it turns out you can make a SSD as big as you want if you design the boards and just keep slapping memory chips on there.
And you call it a prototype and don't expect to actually sell it anytime soon.
That seems like a 2021 or 2022 product. Mm, maybe late 2020.
I think, is 4 terabytes still the biggest on the market? Or there might be 6.
There's probably stuff in enterprise that's way bigger. But
I mean, in terms of consumer.
For normal consumer.
You can get your hands on and
you
pay.
You can get 4 terabytes. The sweet spot for price to size right now is 2 terabytes, it seems like.
Yeah.
Because you can get those for under 10 cents a gigabyte.
Okay. Last I checked, I think a 4 terabyte SSD will still run you like $500.
Yeah, that seems right. That's still, I mean, that's, look, I feel like I could live on a 2 terabyte drive as my primary computer right now pretty comfortably.
Yeah, sure.
Without having even a spinning disk, maybe. Yeah. I'd have to manage that. You wouldn't install Call of Duty and Destiny at the same time.
Probably not.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you, let's say you had some sort of network attached storage, perhaps that would make that a lot easier to not have a bunch of drives in your PC.
Yeah.
I got excited seeing this because I am
your dream.
I'm very eager to get to a point where we can run a NAS with SSDs instead of platter drives, because I feel like that is the biggest fear about long-term data storage is having hard drives fail.
So,
and once you remove the mechanical failure aspect of that equation, it gets a lot less scary.
Don't start ripping 4K Blu-rays then is my advice.
Okay.
Cause those are like 45 gigs each.
Yeah.
Even if you compress the shit out of them with H.265.
Yeah. But that, this seems like we're getting closer to that.
Probably,
yeah. These SSD sizes, I feel like, are really inflating rapidly.
I mean, the 3D NAND stuff that Intel and Micron, I think, announced a few years ago is in full production now, and it seems to be really increasing density a lot. So, yeah, it's. I mean, I think that stuff won't be on M2 drives, but that's fine because, like, for storage.
Yeah, you don't need super high performance for just.
Yeah, I'm fine plugging into SATA 6.
Largely static storage. How far off do you think we are from hard drives not really being widely available anymore? 10 years?
I think that they'll continue to be important for data centers for a really long time.
Okay.
I don't know what the state of the art on hard drive tech is. Like, I know that they've pushed through limits, like theoretical max limits, a couple of times by like doing things like changing the bits from a horizontal orientation, parallel with the platter to perpendicular to the platter. So they're because the actual bits have a three-dimensional shape that's okay. It's kind of like a pill capsule.
So you stand them on their end, you can fit more of them on there.
Yeah, you stand on your end, you get way more in there. I don't know. I feel like the amount of data that we generate as a species requires spinning platters for a while.
Maybe so.
If you think about it, we've gone from generating a couple petabytes a year to thousands of exabytes a year over the last two decades.
Do we really need to keep all of that?
Well, I mean, that's a larger question, but if you go through and start deleting my baby pictures, I'm probably going to be pretty upset with you,
that's
Google.
Fair. Okay, yeah, that's fair.
Should we talk about this Intel GPU?
Sure.
This I almost put this in stuff that isn't real.
Yeah, because there's not a lot of detail to go on.
Well, so it's called the DG1. It's a discrete GPU. It's the second. So Intel, about every decade, goes through the, hey, we need to make a discrete GPU phase,
yeah,
starting in like the late 90s, post 3DFX.
Yeah, we talked about that a little bit on the ray tracing episode.
Yeah. They did Larrabee in the middle 2000s. Now we're back at it again.
right on schedule.
And from what I can tell, I read Gordon Mong's article at PC World, which seemed to be the best of the ones that I saw. He said they gave no details about what the internals are. All they said is it's basically the same GPU that's going to be in their 10 nanometer CPUs, presumably coming later this year.
Yeah, that's Tiger Lake, I believe.
Tiger Lake, yeah.
So that'll be the, like, you know, the next generation of, like, we're on, you know, 9900 now.
Yeah, and this is 10X.
However people want to pronounce that, the 10900K.
Yes, yeah. Whatever.
Whatever the next gen is.
And so, like, as always with Intel GPUs, they run the same GPU core on each CPU die, and like the ones that are on, you know, ultra lightweight laptops has a very, very small amount of space dedicated to that, and the one that's in a desktop processor has a lot of space dedicated to that. So you get varying performance based on the power requirements of the platform. But I think the goal with this Tiger Lake GPU is they're always trying to be competent at mass market for games. So things like Fortnite, in the old days, they were always targeting StarCraft 2 and Minecraft and stuff like that. Now it's going to be Fortnite and Overwatch. And I don't know. What do people play? What are the big multiplayer games? Probably not PUBG because it's kind of a hog.
Yeah. I'm trying to think what besides Fortnite and Overwatch, like those kind of.
Apex Legends, probably.
Apex, yeah. I mean, Minecraft's
pretty lightweight. So maybe Siege, stuff like that.
Sure.
Stuff that people play
in
large quantities.
Yes. Do you have a sense of, like, does the GPU in a 9900K right now run Fortnite acceptably well?
I only know about that in terms of what you can do on VR.
Okay.
Because I'm always looking for a smaller, lighter laptop that will run VR so I can do demos. None of the Intel GPUs have run VR stuff.
Really?
Okay. With any reliability.
So still a ways to go then.
One of the things that I was told early on with this generation of GPUs is that they were targeting VR.
Okay.
So min-spec VR. Things that will run on your Oculus with a 970 type graphics card. So which also opens the door to pretty much everything that ships for PS4 and Xbox One.
Sure.
Stuff like that. So like it's potentially interesting. This is the developer board.
Yeah. Like I was going to ask, I mean, does this even read to you like this is going to result in an on the shelf?
I would be shocked.
PCIe card?
No, they're giving this to developers so that they have them in the pipeline early enough that people can be aware like put this into their testing for games that are upcoming.
Okay. So Intel graphics cards right next to AMD and NVIDIA, not going to happen anytime soon.
I would be surprised.
On store shelves. I mean,
look, the reason they do this is because they don't have the CPUs ready to ship now.
Okay.
And
it's probably just a development sample, basically.
Yeah, it's cheap. Well, if you think about it, it's cheaper for everybody. Like, if I'm a developer, I don't want to have to spin up an extra, like, if they send me a motherboard and a CPU, I'd much rather have just a video card I can drop into one of the other 45 million test machines I have.
Sure.
So, yeah.
All right. So maybe nothing to get super excited about.
I don't think it's, I would be very surprised if these are on shelves in Best Buy. The one thing that was interesting out of this, though, is that they're talking about potentially letting you use integrated and discrete together. So maybe they will ship one as
I think it was Tom's Hardware was speculating about that.
Oh yeah. Never mind.
Ooh,
sorry. Tom's Hardware burn.
Some speculation I saw. Yeah. That like, well, but again, that would require you to have to
have an external
card. One of these cards. Yeah. And that may not happen. So
yeah.
Who knows? Weird to bring a product to CES and barely say anything about it, but.
Well, but you got to get the develop. Like you got to get it out for developers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
sure.
Like this is
The consumer electronics.
They spend a lot of money on those booths, so they got to have some stuff that gets press.
Developer outreach is important.
Yeah. Intel's one of the last of the huge like PC companies that's still there.
Really?
Yeah. Because like Microsoft hasn't been at CES in 5 years, no 7 kidding. Years, something like that.
Huh.
Yeah. Yeah. It used to be Intel and Microsoft were right next to each other, and then Microsoft went away, and then it's always been like some Chinese TV company or phone company or something there. Yeah. Huh.
Yeah. Is AMD there or did this announcement happen around it?
They may be there. I don't know.
Like I saw an interview from their CEO's Lisa Su. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
She was saying that the Zen 3 stuff is going to be out there this year.
What is Zen 3, Brad?
Zen 3 is the next, we talked about it last week. It's their next generation microarchitecture.
For CPU. For
CPUs. Yeah. All the current Ryzen chips are on Zen 2.
Yeah. So it's the chiplet design and all that stuff, right?
Right. It's like the internals of the chip itself, the logic and how it processes instructions and stuff like that.
It's interesting.
The rumors, and again, these are rumors, who knows how valid they are, but they were saying that on an instruction per clock basis, there are going to be performance gains of like 15 to 20% with the Zen 3 stuff, which is big.
Yeah.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, that's that's like in terms of...
especially for games, because my understanding is the games are still not as multi-threaded as you might think they should be at this point.
Well, so does that mean they're doing a deeper pipeline?
I don't know. I didn't read into like where those gains are coming from.
Huh.
It sounds very substantial.
Well, so the thing that's interesting about AMD is usually the places that they've really blown up and had massive success, like with the original Athlon and the K6 and stuff like that, are when Intel hits the limits of a process technology. Because Intel's secret sauce is, hey, we're just going to make it smaller and use less power and then make it faster. Whereas AMD is often like being more parallel or doing more instructions per clock or whatever.
Yeah.
And like Intel is reaching the 10 nanometers is approaching the end of what we can do with process tech as we understand it right now.
Well, most everybody else is on 7 now.
Well, right? I mean, Intel's deliberately been slowing their push down.
I see. Yeah. Do they do all their own fabrication?
I believe so.
Okay.
I believe they own their own fabs.
That maybe has something to do with it.
Hmm. I mean, yeah, but if like TSMC has 7-nanometer fabs, then Intel will have 7-nanometer fabs. They might just be using it for something. They might be using it for enterprise or something else where there's like more money than consumer market. I don't know about that. The thing I was going to say is that AMD is in a position where with their chiplet design, moving away from the monolithic chip has given them a big advantage in flexibility and like binning, so they can put more of the more performant chips cores on one chip, and that gives them a big advantage.
I'm trying to think like outside of like the workstation context, like what are some consumer oriented workloads that a CPU with that many threads
video editing
relevant to? Yeah. I mean, even that is not really consumer level.
I mean, I don't know. Everybody not at does
a performance level.
Well,
like streaming. I mean, I guess the classic example is like, hey, you can run a game and stream it at a high bit rate and not feel any
and not have to do two PCs. Like
that. Or let's say you're running Handbrake every night, crunching a bunch of Blu-rays or something. Like there are some applications for it, but like
some of these
super high end thread rippers, it's just like I can't think of a use case for that on a home desktop.
Well, but so if you're like a photographer, it's going to be for niche home use, right? It's going to be people who are into making videos or people who are into doing animation or people who are into like photography even. Like if you look at the math that happens on like the denoising algorithms and stuff like that, that you run on a modern, even on like a DSLR photo, those are intense.
Sure.
I mean, it'll take a while to run them on 10,000 photos. like right now, a lot of video houses workload for like people who do YouTube videos and stuff like we do, like you do at Giant Bomb, is you, I mean, you guys don't do a ton of edited stuff, but when you do edited stuff, there's a moment where you walk away and hit the button and you walk away for an hour.
Massive amount of render time.
Yeah. And then you come back and it's done.
Yeah.
And if that hour goes to 25 seconds, right?
Yeah. That's a big deal. Yeah. But again, that's not an end user, like a home application necessarily. That's what I was getting at.
Yeah. I don't,
like outside of like heavy media work, I can't think of a lot of reason for the average person at home to,
I don't think there has to be
to need 32 cores.
No, but there isn't. Look, do we need 8 cores? No, we need 2 cores, really. Mm-hmm. Most people.
Sure.
4 is nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we're at a point now where the hardware is out there and it's up to developers to figure out what to do with it.
Sure.
So
that's fair.
I mean, I think we're going to see a lot of that with the next console generation too, since they have 8 cores now.
Yeah. Well, these current ones have 8-ish or like 7, I think.
Yeah, but they
but they're crappy network CPUs that.
Yeah. They were low capability.
Yeah. Like the ones in the new ones are like actual real big boy CPUs.
I think that's probably, I mean, hey, Sony unveiled the PS5 logo.
They sure did.
Looked like a logo. It looked like just like the PS4 logo, but with a 5 instead of a 4.
I don't know about that choice of 5, to be
honest.
You think
so?
I don't know if they've had this font that they've been sitting on for 25 years and that this is just the time for the 5 to shine.
I thought they should have made the 5 look like the backwards S.
Right. That's kind of how I was feeling that it was a little bit too angular. It doesn't fit.
Brad, I think we should shut down the podcast. We should open a branding design studio, consulting studio. Yes. Look, everything looks weird when you see it the first time. In like 3 months, we're not going to notice anymore.
Yeah. Yes.
Are you going to do some predictions for 2020s? Or you feel
sure.
I was thinking about this because you suggested this the other day. And I was like, man, there's so much. I just looked around my office and I was like, there's 15 things in here that I never could have predicted Beat Saber in 2010.
Yeah.
I never even thought VR would be real in 20. Like, I didn't think there was any chance we would see anything like VR in 2010.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Gosh, like, what are the big trends right now?
Space, going to space is getting cheap.
I guess so. Yeah.
VR seems to be leading to AR.
Yeah. I feel like the public private split on space, I hesitate to call it space exploration, but it's more like space industry, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that balance hasn't been figured out yet.
No,
like,
not
we're still,
at all.
We're still in the formative stages of like, oh, private companies are doing what the government is not willing to fund right now.
Well, except for the government is also funding them.
But then, yes, they're
because,
still getting, yes.
You know, like SpaceX is the number one contractor.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
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 So for me, like if you could spend $50,000 and that would give you a couple of orbits.
I don't know, man. That's a lot of money,
but you get to go to space.
Yeah.
What if you go to $50,000, you could stay there for 2 weeks, have a little vacation,
maybe
go to the space beach.
Sure.
I don't know. I'm really kind of up in the air on the future of a lot of stuff. Like
I feel pessimistic about the coming decade, but
well, okay. So there was a thing that came out last week. We didn't talk about it, I don't think, but it was about sulfur. Somebody figured out how to make sulfur diodes in lithium batteries, which increases the capacity for energy storage a lot. But it's been challenging because the sulfur anodes shrink and contract like 70% in the course of charging and discharging. And that makes the battery structurally unsound, which is problematic. I think we're going to see, we've seen enough of these like theoretical breakthroughs that haven't turned into real breakthroughs that I think probably one of them will hit and is manufacturable in the next decade.
Sure.
So I think in 10 years, the idea of plugging your phone in to charge every night is going to seem quaint.
I could definitely see that.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I could, I'm sure there will be some pretty major,
there's a prediction right
low,
there.
Low level tech breakthroughs that will change people's lifestyles in positive ways.
I also think that HP is into WebOS for the long haul.
Okay.
I think they're going to bring that back.
Huh.
And we're going to see, this is going to be the decade that WebOS starts to challenge iOS and Android.
Still to this day, hear a lot of people say glowing things about WebOS. I mean, I had a touchpad.
It's on every LG TV.
I still have a touchpad around here somewhere. Yeah, it's got WebOS on it.
Great piece of hardware.
Right now.
It's WebOS drives LG TVs.
Mm, yeah. Okay. Still out there in some form.
That's my number two prediction.
I think the main thing I felt pessimistic about is the potential for widespread and convincing digital fakery.
I think that's a real problem.
Like, that's the thing I'm worried about maybe more than anything.
I think the fact that major social platforms have come out and said, hey, we are fine with political ads that use deepfakes. We're not going to ban those.
Yeah. Well, that's just
problematic.
That's just pure policy. You know, I'm talking more about like deepfake stuff becoming.
Well I think the
alarmingly
problem,
effective.
Here's a prediction. I think that this next decade is going to be defined by policy slamming up against technology.
Okay. Sure.
I think that's going to be the big, more than technological progress, I think figuring out how this interacts with society in a way that doesn't destroy society is going to be really important.
Yes. That's probably a safe bet. Yeah, it made me wonder if like there will be a, I don't know, some kind of large scale investment in like green technologies, or specifically technologies that designed to counteract kind of the existing forces.
You mean like play. Anti,
like carbon scrubbing, like
carbon sinks,
yeah. Stuff like that. But that, you know, that obviously depends on which way the political winds are blowing.
Well, what was it? There was an article a couple of weeks ago that was like, look, if we spent $600 billion on this right now, we could solve this problem right. in the next 10 years.
Yes.
Or which would involve taxing the top 1% an extra 2% or something.
It's yeah. Tough
choices, yeah, really.
Really got to weigh.
It's impossible to decide.
Pros and cons of that one.
I think we're probably going to see AR glasses as a real thing in the next decade.
I saw, I think it was Panasonic brought a pair of VR glasses to CES.
Oh, the goggles? The ones that look like goggles?
They look like futuristic steampunk goggles, but. But my understanding is they are standard VR.
So those were for commercial use, right?
I'm not sure.
They're not consumer product.
I think it may have been a prototype.
Yeah.
They're not on the market.
So no. I've seen goggles like that in the past that were like hand-built prototypes. The problem with those that don't have the unified hole is getting the FOV right. So it doesn't feel like you're looking down a tube.
The write-up did say that they had a very limited field of view compared to the actual headsets on the market.
Yeah. And whereas we've seen the FOVs getting wider and wider, I think we're going to see on the VR front, I think that in the next couple of years, VR is going to very much be a hybrid, you know, headset with a standalone processor that also can tether. I mean, we already see that with the Quest, but the Quest isn't super comfortable.
Yeah.
I think we'll see with the 5G, 6G wireless, we'll see some more wireless implementations of that that makes it a little more feasible.
All right. Well, here we are. It's a new decade.
So your prediction's just doom and gloom? It's all over? Carbon sinks?
Yeah, pretty much.
You got to have something better than that.
I saw an article. I wish I had saved it because I wasn't able to go back and refer to it again. But there was an article the other day about services coming online that can basically, like, the example they gave was they can effectively use AI or machine learning or whatever it is to generate, let's say, like, photographs of fashion model with any combination of, like, gender and ethnicity that you want. And they had a straight up spread right there of the exact same photograph, just like, boom, 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 down the line. Just like one generated face after another. And they were completely convincing. And it just like, again, you know, the potential for political ramifications and the spread of misinformation and stuff based on that sort of thing is just kind of horrifying.
Have we talked about the virtual influencers here yet?
No.
This is an Asia thing right now, but they're trying to make it happen here. So Hatsune Miku is kind of the prototype, but she's a Vocaloid and not necessarily... the virtual influencers are...
You like the ones that are presented as actual humans, like that have Instagram accounts and
and they're just owned by some studio.
Visually indistinguishable from real people.
Yeah.
Yes. I have seen some of that stuff.
It's a nightmare.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there you go. 2020. It's a nightmare.
Dismantle social media.
I think that's probably a good idea.
It's my platform.
I've been working on a bot for Twitter for a while. That's like a block all brands bot. So you just sign up for it and you hook it up to your Twitter account and then it automatically blocks all brand accounts.
That seems good and necessary.
Yeah. It seems like it's a good thing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Cheery. sorry to kick the decade off on the wrong foot.
everything seems like it's going to be great, Brad.
Yeah. Let's keep our fingers crossed.
We'll be back next week with another episode of Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod. We'll do questions and probably not next week, not the week after, but the week after that, maybe
something like that.
Every four or five weeks.
Yeah. It's our podcast.
Yeah.
We can do whatever we want.
Yeah. Next week, we're going to do questions. No answers. It's just, we're going to read questions for 2 hours.
We're going to ask you questions.
Yeah. We want to know what you guys know.
Yeah.
There's a quiz.
Yeah.
If you like the show, please tell your friends about it. That's the best way to let other folks know. Tweet at, you know, Facebook. Use all the social medias that Brad hates to spread the word, please.
Only use them for good, though.
You want to get a sweet face tattoo that has like Brad's face on one side and my face on the other?
Wow.
Probably don't do that. But if you do, send us a picture.
That's brand loyalty.
Yeah. We'll be back next week with more Tech Pod. Thanks for listening, everybody.